Welcome to another edition of the Oncology Peer Review on the Go podcast. I'm your host, Matthew Fowler, and today is Monday, September 28th. This edition of Oncology Peer Review on the Go examines a review article published in the September issue of the journal Oncology. The article, titled Molecular Profiling in Metastatic Colorectal Cancer, was written by Dr. Samantha Armstrong, Rita Malley, and Benjamin Weinberg, and discusses the epidemiology, tumor location, and mutational landscape of metastatic colorectal cancer. For an in-depth evaluation of that piece, I spoke with authors Dr. Armstrong and Dr. Weinberg from the Georgetown Lombardi Comprehensive Cancer Center.
So our review article really just goes into the treatment of metastatic colorectal cancer. It's a type of cancer that still has maintained its traditional chemotherapy backbone. We've really changed our therapeutic landscape because we're understanding the disease's molecular blueprint. Our review touches base on the importance of sidedness with embryologic origins as well as microbiome playing into why there's a difference between right-sided tumors and left-sided tumors, with right-sided tumors having more BRAF and KRAS mutations as well as a higher prevalence of MSI-high, but overall do worse than left-sided tumors. We then dive into the different RAS mutations and how RAS mutations really lead to the resistance of EGFR-targeted therapy. And now there's actually new clinical trials that are looking at the KRAS G12C mutation. So it typically was not a targeted or a targetable mutation, but now with the landscape changing even further, what used to just be known for having resistance to a certain type of targeted therapy, we're now able to target at least one of the KRAS mutations, hopefully in the future. After that, we talk about BRAF mutations, and we discuss that they are also targetable based on the Beacon trial. Then we really dive into mismatch repair deficiency in MSI-high tumors, and this is very exciting in the context of being able to use immunotherapy in metastatic colorectal cancer, and the newest FDA approval is based on the KEYNOTE-177 trial, which actually allows pembrolizumab to be used in the frontline setting, which is very exciting for colorectal cancer to be able to use an immunotherapy in the frontline setting if you have the MSI-high tumor or a mismatch repair deficiency. We complete our review by talking about more rare but also targetable mutations in the HER2 pathway and NTRK pathways.
And I would just say to add on to that excellent summary that the two big takeaways from this review are, one, there are a variety of targets where we really need to be aware of the biomarker because it can guide therapy for both common mutations, fusions, overexpressions, but also these rarer events. And then the other thing to keep in mind with that is that while historically we've ordered sort of a la carte testing, like we'll test BRAF, we'll test KRAS, now, you know, you could, I think, easily make an argument for ordering broad next generation sequencing or even whole exome sequencing on patients earlier on in their disease course, because it could guide subsequent therapies, affect the sequence of therapies, and that information is actually very important. And as Dr. Armstrong said, not only, you know, knowing they have a KRAS mutation, but which KRAS mutation now may actually predict, you know, which therapies patients might benefit from. And the last point I would make is that this is a rapidly evolving field. So even putting together this review, there's a lot of updates over the last year and a half, especially in the BRAF space with the publication of the Beacon study, leading to FDA approval of encorafenib cetuximab. As well as Dr. Armstrong said, in the immunotherapy space with some very new data that was just presented at the ASCO 2020 virtual meeting of the progression-free survival data from the KEYNOTE-177 study showing that frontline pembrolizumab seems to be preferred over standard of care chemotherapy for patients with MSI-high or mismatch repair deficient metastatic colorectal cancer. So not only knowing these biomarkers for the individual patient is important and really tailoring therapy to the individual patient and their tumor characteristics, but also staying on top of this sort of rapidly evolving field is really vital for practitioners.
So kind of taking a step back and looking at this as a whole, what was the process like putting this piece together, and really what was the motivation behind pursuing this topic?
I think our big motivation is that with this ever-changing field, it's hard to stay on top of all of these things. And so Ben and I both wanted to have a very concise, systematic review of the targetable mutations we have right now, a list of the clinical trials that are ongoing, but always keeping in mind that things are ever changing and changing rapidly. So this is at least a starting point for clinicians to be able to read about metastatic colorectal cancer and right now where the field is, so they can at least get things started, but know that they need to stay updated on, you know, the fine details of things changing.
So then focusing in on the specific, some of the specifics of the piece, it mentions this idea of colon cancer sidedness, and it's a significant factor in treating metastatic colorectal cancer. Could you explain what exactly that is and what makes it significant for understanding and treating this disease effectively?
Yeah, so one big thing is that with right and left-sided colon cancer, a decade or two before, there wasn't really that knowledge of there is any difference between where the primary tumor came from. It really was just colon cancer, is it metastatic and what is the stage? Now with understanding the gut biome and maybe how bile acids are affecting the pH of the gut in that area, and also just the anatomy and the embryology of where this part of the organ came from, we're realizing, and there's a lot of studies out there that realize that right-sided tumors tend to do worse, and they have a very different mutational profile than tumors located on the left side or in the rectum. So it really just shows that there's good heterogeneity, even within one organ, the colon, that throughout the colon is not the same, truly the same disease that one person's treating. You need to be aware now where the primary tumor is, since it does guide different mutations and that guides different therapies and overall progression-free survival, response rates to certain drugs, and overall survival really does, it does tell a blueprint all the way back from where that first tumor started.
Towards the top of that piece, it also mentions that the results of molecular research have demonstrated the need to profile these patients for KRAS and BRAF mutations, MSIH status, HER2 amplifications. I was hoping you could put this into context for the listeners, you know, specifically, how is this different than the current practices? And what does this type of profiling add to benefit this treatment?
Ben, you want to take that one?
Sure. I mean, I think what we summarize really is the standard of care and really what folks should be doing in practice. Everything we say is really in line with the NCCN guidelines. Just to be aware, again, what we tend to be mostly focused on RAS mutations, BRAF mutations, that knowledge of the patient's HER2 amplification status, you know, may inform use of off-label drugs that we borrow from our breast cancer colleagues targeting HER2, and a lot of very exciting clinical trials in development using novel tyrosine kinase inhibitors targeting HER2 as well as antibody drug conjugates. So it would better inform not only standard of care practice, but also selection for clinical trials. And as we've talked about, there are also these sort of very rare but very actionable findings like the NTRK fusions, which again, it's like sort of finding the golden ticket in a sense, but we only will find it if we look for it. So those are tests that are, again, frequently included in, as part of large next generation sequencing, whole exome sequencing platforms that may be missed if folks are just ordering, you know, their standard kind of a la carte BRAF, KRAS, and then they're done. And as discussed previously, even knowing which KRAS or BRAF mutation is actually very vital in terms of guiding not only standard therapies, but selection for potential therapeutic clinical trials.
And so looking ahead to maybe the next 5 or 10 years, you know, how do you see the field evolving specifically in the context of molecular profiling?
I'll start. I think generally the more data that we know, there could be currently mutations of undetermined significance, that the more data that we have, the more people that we test, that undetermined significance actually might turn significant and lead to more targeted trials. So I think just promoting broad sequencing, full panel profiles on most patients. We'll gather that data to make educated decisions on treatment now, but then also lead in that translational component of the sciences to think, what other targets are there? Is this truly insignificant, or is this something that we could target or combine with other therapies to take advantage of the mutations and have a synergistic response to lead to overall tumor death?
Yeah, I would reiterate to say that, you know, broad sequencing really helps enable more effective drug development. And we're very jealous of our colleagues in the thoracic oncology space, where they've taken a brutal cancer, non-small cell lung cancer, and been able to divide the pie of that type of tumor, which used to just be, you know, squamous or non-squamous, into now many different slices of the pie with potentially targetable actual mutations. You know, we hope to do the same with colorectal cancer, and I think you're starting to see hopefully the beginnings of that. And as Dr. Armstrong says, by doing the sequencing, we're informing kind of future drug development by seeing the mutational frequencies and potential targets. And things like NTRK are a good story where, you know, we had NTRK fusions, but until we had a drug that targeted it, nobody really cared about it. And now it's extremely sought after. So I think we hope that we'll see more of those types of interventions going forward.
Yeah. And drugs that can lead to durable response so that people can live longer, have longer progression-free survivals, and overall good quality of life. If we can get away from chemotherapy and some of these drugs that have a better side effect profile that patients can tolerate better, that'd be great too.
And so lastly, really, is there anything that I haven't mentioned regarding this piece or the field in general that you feel is important to talk about here?
Things are changing quickly, and the gut biome can be, I think, a big component in the next decade or two of the next piece of the puzzle that we are thinking about, but we don't have an answer to. I think that could lead into more data and maybe more fine-tooth, really precision medicine, and treating each patient very unique from where their tumor came from, what mutations their tumor harbors, and also what did their gut flora tell us about this. I think having all the components and thinking about the patient as a whole, from their tumor to their hereditary to the mutations and to what their flora looks like, is really that what we're going for in the future, is treating the entire patient and precision of treating the patient.
I agree. And again, this paper and our focus thus far has really been on the tumor and trying to tease out as much information from the tumor as possible. But as we recognize, the tumor does not exist in a vacuum, right? So historically, we've done a poor job of analyzing host factors. And one of the big ones, especially in the colon space, is the microbiome, as Dr. Armstrong said. So I think through further testing, we have a better idea about both the immune microenvironment, but also the microbial microenvironment that allows these cancers to grow and persist. And again, while our focus has been on the tumor, we may see more research and more therapeutic development in these sort of host microenvironments space. And the last thing I would say is that this type of work really behooves patients to be educated and informed, and to query their oncologist about their molecular profile and to say, well, have I had HER2 tested? Have I had NTRK testing? Because the oncologist may not be up on things, and it behooves educating our patients and our patient advocates to really be proponents of molecular profiling and to get the best, you know, standard of care that they can achieve.
Well, those are all the questions I have for you, Dr. Armstrong, Dr. Weinberg. Thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
For the article's response perspective, I spoke with Dr. John Marshall of the Georgetown Lombardi Comprehensive Cancer Center. Dr. Marshall discussed the cost, quality of care, accessibility, and much more regarding molecular profiling and precision medicine. So, Dr. Marshall, thank you so much for joining me today. I was hoping we could start, just to help give the listeners an idea of what we're talking about, if you could kind of briefly describe what precision medicine, specifically molecular profiling, is, and, you know, the benefits of using this practice.
You know, I'm old enough to know that over the last 20 years, we used to just do whatever chemo we were going to give a patient based on their primary diagnosis and where the tumor came from, in essence. And now we know that it doesn't stop there. We are moving to what is called molecular medicine. And everyone on the line knows what that means. It starts with just one or two molecular markers, say ER, PR, HER2 for breast cancer. Then comes along EGFR targeting for, say, colon cancer or maybe for lung cancer. And there's been this evolution of more and more genes, more and more molecular characteristics that separate our patients' cancers into different groups. And with that has come medicines that go along with that. So we've gone from a sort of one size fits all to everybody's in a different bucket and needs different treatment. And so precision medicine is here to stay and only expanding.
Okay, so I was hoping you could talk a little bit about the perspective piece you wrote in the September issue of the journal that pairs with a review article that's being published. You know, some of the key points that you make in it and what you really hope to accomplish with it.
Yeah, so the first part is that it's recently, in the last 10 years or so, come to really my awareness that cancer care on a global scale is really a luxury item. To deliver the kinds of cancer care that we deliver requires an immense team of highly trained professionals with lots of tools, both equipment and access to medicines and the like, and to really do the highest quality of cancer care, to enjoy all of the success that we have been experiencing in the progress that we have been making requires a big investment. And so much of the world really doesn't have that level of resource. And so cancer care becomes a luxury item for those areas that have access to all of those things. Paired to that is this dramatic increase in drug costs. Drug development has gotten more expensive. And if you put that together with precision medicine forcing smaller and smaller buckets of patients, you see that you get a collision coming, that fewer people will be able to consume these medicines because they're rarer subtypes. Much of the world doesn't have access to this. So I've really felt that this concept of precision medicine was something that could easily be expanded to larger areas of the population around the world and would enable a much more rapid drug development, which would drop price, which would expand access again. So this was an important concept for me to try and dedicate some of my own time and own resources to trying to develop this infrastructure.
And so that response gets at a really good point that you discuss in that perspective, talking about the haves and the have-nots globally regarding cancer care. And you say that nowhere is that more dramatic in medical care than oncology. I was hoping you could expand on this idea. What would need, you kind of talk a little bit about expanding care globally to bring prices down. What would need to happen to really shrink that disparity between the two sides?
Well, let me give you a great example. In the travels back when we could travel, I visited many cancer centers around the world. And the physicians there, we'll just use one example, are very aware of the concept of markers for immuno-oncology, immune therapy. And the most dramatic of which is microsatellite instability. But I was recently at a country that will go nameless that has brilliant physicians and all the tools, but IO-oncology therapies are not approved for patients in that setting. And so they don't want to know. They don't actually want to do the test, even though they know that if a patient has microsatellite instability, there is a therapy out there that could dramatically alter for the better that patient's life. And so how do we solve that? Well, the barrier there is not knowledge, is not the ability to manufacture. It is simply a price of the medicine. Right? The global price is so high that there are regions of the world that just can't afford that. So we have to lower those costs. And there are ways to do that. If we can speed drug development so that the outlay for companies is in fact less, if we can change intellectual property laws that allow for companies who truly innovate in this space to enjoy profits for longer, then the net price can fall. And let's face it, I mean, the United States' current model for how we pay for drugs is part of the reason why global prices have not fallen. We pay for a lot of drug development around the world because of our model. And whoever gets elected in the election ahead, both parties want to change this. And there will be a fight. There will be a knockdown, drag-out fight between what is a powerful pharmaceutical industry that has done a lot of good for us. And so we do want to protect that, but against a financial pressure that we have to somehow meet in the middle.
So then expanding off that, you know, what does the future have in store for GI cancers? And I guess specifically in regard to precision medicine, you know, do you see this as something where that kind of structure of global problems within, you know, affording cause, is that more of like an optimistic view? Do you think that could realistically change in the next 5 to 10 years?
I think the only way we're going to move forward in GI cancers is through not only the current levels of precision medicine, but expanding it yet one more level. Because right now we're fairly routinely doing what's called next-gen sequencing on a lot of patients with GI cancers. And yes, we have found some things, but I think we've pulled a lot of the low-hanging fruit off of the DNA. And so I actually believe the next wave of precision medicine will include proteins and phosphoproteins and RNA analysis, and in GI cancer, particularly studying the microbiome, the bacterial interface between us and our world in our GI tracts. And this is where it gets really interesting and why we need a global collaboration, because the colon cancers and the microbiome here in, say, Washington, D.C. is different molecularly than the colon cancer and the microbiome in, say, Tokyo or Seoul. And so until we begin to understand the complexity on a global scale as we interface with our environment, we won't find the next tier of lessons that we will uncover or secrets of cancer biology. And so honestly, I think it's not only important that we collaborate as a nation, but as a world looking at these new concepts.
So that's really, really great insight. I guess lastly, just is there anything that I haven't mentioned or asked regarding your perspective or the field in general that you think is important to share right now?
Yeah, I think as we struggle with our political world today, as we struggle with COVID and all of the issues, because cancer care, of course, is not elective, and we have had to continue our treatment, we're all pretty down on things. And I think those of us particularly lucky enough to have all the bells and whistles and all the tools around us, we need to remind ourselves of just how lucky we are and the high level of cancer care we can provide. And at the same time, think about our colleagues around the world and how can we help them provide for their patients as well. I do think it is not a time for building walls. It is a time for lowering them and collaborating. And nowhere is that more important in the world of cancer.
Dr. Marshall, this is great insight. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate speaking with you.
My pleasure, Matthew. And thanks for having me.
All right. Take care. Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology Peer Review on the Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available. Or listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. The Oncology Peer Review on the Go podcast is the official podcast of Cancer Network, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on Twitter @CancerNetwork without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn @CancerNetwork.